welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Sing it, Bill.
Hey, our sponsor this hour, Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Honda steel dealer. Pape Machinery carries everything for your yard, garden, and small farm. If you need parts, service, brand new equipment, go see them. They're at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or you can get them on the web at PapeMachinery.com or give them a call at 226-9226. They got it going on down there. And they are open. They're essential.
Absolutely. And if you're going to have, all this rain, and, you know, as soon as the sun comes out after all this rain, we're going to get... going to get hammered with loads of grass and
all the rest of it. Grass is going to grow about a foot a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, better get nuts. It before it gets dry, too. Got to fix our guest's name on the website. I only gave him one T. Bing! Now he's got two. Okay, so let's see. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. We have shows dating back 10 years. I've kind of grouped some at the top of the page, shows about veterans, South Africa, China, Islam, environmentalism, and marijuana, because we've done enough on all of those, especially the China shows in the last, 17 months or so. I think you'll find very, very interesting in light of what's going on in the world at this particular point in time. Anyway, we hope you will join us on there. We have a lot of people who used to listen on Wednesdays. But now that a lot of people are trapped at home, people are listening almost any time. And the archives are free to use, free to listen to. They are MP3 files. You can do whatever you like with them. Download them, share them, do whatever you want, whatever's helpful with that information. And what was the other thing that was skimming through my mind? Oh, yeah, you can find us on Channel 23 if you're a Rabbit Ears TV person. Channel 23 in the Reading area and other places on the American Uncensored Network. It's a TV network. So that's kind of fun. And let's see, our guest. Is he in there? He is in there. Matt. We had to postpone Matt last week. My bad. We were having an actual... I was having just plain old run-of-the-mill bronchitis, but it had the scary sound. It made people freak out. It had nothing to do with the virus, but...
Get back.
It was scary. It was scary for people anyway, so anyway, I stayed home. But Matt is the cousin of one of my coworkers, and so that's kind of fun. She's always told me all sorts of good things about him, and I think I might have met him at her wedding, but did I meet you at Lisa's wedding, Matt?
I can't remember.
Were you at Lisa's wedding?
I wasn't able to make it.
Oh, okay, so I totally didn't meet you then.
Yeah, that's correct.
Maybe she just talked about you. I'm like, did we sit next to each other at Lisa's wedding? Let's see. Matt served for 22 years, half of those in the Special Operations Aviation Regiment, SOAR. His first combat deployment was in January 2002 to Afghanistan, and by the time he retired in 2010, he had completed 7 combat deployments to Afghanistan and Iraq. Flew countless combat missions supporting U.S. Army Rangers, Green Berets, Navy SEALs, and other Tier 1 Special Operations units. And I'm not going to read the next paragraph because that'll wreck your whole story. But tell the whole thing. But as a retired, the little blurb on here I thought was very good for your website. And the website is thrivingonmission.com. A retired U.S. Army Special Operations pilot shares with veterans and other listeners his story of learning how to thrive, not just survive, as a combat veteran. Really timely.
Yes, no kidding. It's interesting just with the times we're living in now. I mean, I even have to find myself now just really focusing on that.
Yeah, and tearing yourself away from the 24/7 news.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's just, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
It's gotten to be a little bit much. So, Anyway, well, Bill and I are looking forward to chatting with you, even though Bill hasn't been able to say anything. We've had Bill, we've had a sack over Bill's head. We'll take it off now.
Oh, hi.
Hey, Bill.
How are you, Matt?
Doing great. How about you?
Oh, I'm sheltering in place like all the other good minions. So
Bill takes his Corona stick out to the store and keeps everybody away. He said he was in Trader Joe's the other day and people were.
Yeah, it was really strange. It was just everybody was almost on autopilot. They were looking down, and it was just a very strange vibe in there. They were walking faster and, you know, grabbing stuff off the shelf. And it's like, I got to get out of here.
Yeah, it's not good. So when you came back, how long did it take before you had this idea, your Thriving on Mission idea?
Oh, gosh. I think it was probably the past year that it really started to solidify. So that was about, 9 years after I got out. A couple years after, or that was probably, and then, 7 years after we finished our missionary service overseas. And so, I think part of the big thing is I was just trying to, again, figure it out for myself, even though I don't have it figured out yet, but I'm moving, I think, in a positive direction. And so I've always been one to want to help others and to serve and so as I started to learn some of these things, some of these thoughts, I just said, it would be great to be able to give back to other veterans and other people who are either going through the same thing or they know somebody who's going through the same thing.
And is it focused primarily on PTSD?
Yeah,
or is that just a component?
I would say, I guess you could say yes, but at the same time, I mean, I think there's a lot of valuable things that I've learned that can help anybody, just because I think, and again, especially right now, because everybody, is probably experiencing some form of anxiety in one way or the other. And I mean, that's a huge one, that's a huge symptom of post-traumatic stress. This increased anxiety, this always on edge, and who isn't experiencing that right now?
Mm-hmm.
And also the other one too is isolation. I mean, well, at least for me, that was, one of my go-to unhealthy coping mechanisms is to isolate, and which is, ironic, I guess, because that's what we have to do now is isolate. And so it's really important to come up with some healthy mechanisms, whatever that might be for you, because you don't have a choice, really. You have to isolate now.
Right. And so that's kind of in the world of PTSD, that's a common thing that people with that issue would isolate themselves, and it's always a way of how do you get them out. So
yeah.
how do you work with
yeah.
them now that getting out is...
Yeah, now
all
that,
about
now
going
that they
in.
Have to isolate, and you got to tell them it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually something that I've thought about over the past week, and it really is, my heart's breaking right now because I was informed, not somebody that I know, but a friend of mine who has a friend, a friend of mine who's actually, he's a pastor, and somebody that he befriended and got to know and ended up baptizing him and his wife, but again, as somebody who was suffering and from post-traumatic stress he ended up trying to take his life a couple weeks ago.
Oh boy.
Thankfully, somebody was able to find him, but I can't even, and you can't even go to the hospital and just sit
right.
with somebody now. And so it's...
Well, that's true, because if people are in the hospital, that's right, you can't go visit them.
And so my heart just breaks right now because I know what so many people are going through, and again, especially, veterans, because, for wanting to isolate, and it's so easy then to go towards these
mm-hmm.
Coping mechanisms, whether it's, and then you can start, drinking a lot, or maybe it's, abusing drugs or whatever. And so how does that...
it's just feeding the beast.
Right. And it's going to be, unfortunately, we know people are going to die from this pandemic. And at the same time, there's going to be other casualties that occur because of this, and I would just encourage, though, if you're a veteran, there's plenty of resources out there. we always think that we're by ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so you think, oh, I'm the only one that's experiencing these things, but that's not the truth. And
we have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, let's talk about some of that, because I have a question for you on, like, the telehealth that the VA is using, and if you have a host of resources, we would love to have you share those
and
post them online, absolutely. So you are listening to We the People. Our guest is Matt Roeke. We will be back in 2 minutes, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
When the wolf growls at the door, hey, I'm solid, hey, I'm steady, hey, I'm true down to the core, and I will always do my duty, no matter what the price. I've counted up the cost, I know the sacrifice. Oh, and I don't wanna die for you, but if dying's asking me, I'll bear that cross with honor. Soldier, an American, beside my brothers and my sisters, I will proudly take a stand. When liberty's in jeopardy, I will always do what's right. I'm out here on the front lines, sleep in peace tonight. American soldier.
Hats off to all of our currently serving military and all of our veterans. Matt, were you always in the Army?
Yep, sure was. Joined when I was 18.
You and my brother. Actually, I think my brother joined when it was that program where you join as a I think it was a sophomore in high school.
Okay. Yeah.
And then when you graduate, you go in.
Yep.
Yeah. So whatever that was, he eventually went into the Special Forces and was a Green Beret for a period of time.
Wow.
Back in Lebanon, right after they blew up the barracks.
Wow.
Was when he went over there, and then we never really knew what he was doing after that.
Yeah.
Kind of. He was probably lots of places we weren't. So, anyway,
right.
Hats off to you. So, after all this, I mean, we, the people who didn't serve and didn't deploy, you can't imagine what, you can see all the movies in the world and you're never going to know because you weren't there. So for those folks that came back, and I would imagine almost everybody has some kind of issues of one form or fashion, and we have a lot of people that are not doing anything about that, what would you share with them by way of help?
There's some great organizations that are out there right now. Thankfully, I've been able to experience a couple of them firsthand. But I think it's important, just sort of what I said right before the break, I was just saying that, for these veterans to realize that what they're going through is not it's not just them. They're not some, fluke that they're the only ones that are dealing with this, whether that's, fear, anxiety, guilt, shame, anger, and I think once they can realize that, and then, because the tendency is, I don't want to go into a group that maybe, group discussion or something like that with other veterans, because it's part of, our persona, that we're strong, we're tough, we're not going to, you know, we don't want to come across as weak. And so for me to be able to serve or to say, you know, hey, I'm struggling with something, obviously that's not something we want to do. But, you know, once people realize that, hey, I'm not in this by myself, that there's other people out there that have gone through this and that are going through it, and they're willing just to listen to me. And I think that's a big one, too.
And they actually know what you're talking about, too. That helps.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is, you know, on some of my podcasts, you know, I've talked about the fact that, I mean, I'm doing this selfishly because it's therapy for me.
Yeah, shamelessly promote the podcast, would you, by the way?
Yeah, it's thrivingonmission.com. And I'd link all my podcast shows there. We do a video once a week, and then we get that on all the major podcast hosts, you know, Apple, Google, CastBox, things like that. And even the way that came about was just, again, something that it was a huge blessing, because once I started doing it, I was like, wow, this is really therapeutic for me. And then I started to receive this feedback from some friends of mine, other vets, who just really appreciated some of the things I was saying, because it helped them identify, and they realized, hey, I'm not alone. Really good stuff there.
Are the programs that you're familiar with, are most of those led by former vets and people that have similar experiences?
Yes, yes. And I think that's a big thing for a veteran. I was talking about it with one of my friends a couple weeks ago on our show, and you know, and this is a hard one to really talk through and explain, because, you know, other people experience post-traumatic stress. This isn't just something for veterans to have, you know, the monopoly on. This is something that people in any type of, because it's post-traumatic, you know, so any type of traumatic incident or event can cause this if the person doesn't get some type of counseling fairly soon after the event. And so rape victims, sexual trauma, accident victims, you know, natural disasters, a lot of people can get this. And so, you know, when I talk about, you know, the fact that these organizations that are run by other veterans, they just seem more effective to me. And I think because they bring some credibility, and not that, I mean, I've talked to other counselors before, both the VA and at the civilian practice, and I think at an individual level, they mean really well, pastors as well. But so many times I hear, and other veterans have heard, you know, something to the effect of, you know, it's an empathetic statement of, wow, I can't really identify what you've gone through. I don't know.
But I'm going to give you advice anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, and it's well-meaning, you know, and they're trying the best they can. But, you know, there's just something different about it to when I've got, you know, somebody who has been there, done that, and they're a little bit further down the line than I am as far as coming to terms with everything that's gone on and things going in my head. And then, you know, and they talk about what they experienced, and they said, hey, and these are some of the things that have helped. And they share their story and the things that they've messed up at. And again, there's just, you know, and what's funny is I'm not the only one. Talking to other veterans, we've experienced similar things. You know, so it's not to, I guess, to, you know, to talk bad about the programs that are out there that are run by civilians without these experiences. Because again, there are veterans who are able to respond to those programs as well and do very well in them. But a program I just went to back at the beginning of the month, it was called the Mighty Oaks Foundation. It was an incredible program, and it was run, it's a week-long, 5-day retreat, and it's run by combat veterans who have had post-traumatic stress. And so they've also gone through this program. So there's a huge amount of credibility that comes with that, because they're not just saying, hey, try this because this is what the book says. They're saying, I experienced what you've experienced. Try this because it's worked for me.
Yeah, that's a huge difference.
Now, we're kind of talking about group type things, but I'm really curious, and I always ask a lot of the veterans I work with through work, about the online, the telehealth that they use. And most of that, I don't know if it's always counseling, maybe psychiatry too, but just because we have so much shortage of, you know, so many shortages of doctors around, you know, around the country. And so they've started doing more with telehealth. Have you ever used it? And what do you think about it? And I know it's everybody's, you know, everybody's got an opinion, but I'm curious what you think.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I did do some telehealth. I think I did, 7 or 8 sessions around probably about 2000, I guess it would have been 2013. And, I did not have a good experience with it. I felt that, you know, the counselor I was meeting with, she was top notch, and as far as, you know, and she really cared and really wanted, you know, to help me. But because it was a program, there was, and this is for me, you know, the fact that I knew that, hey, we're going to meet for 12 sessions, 13 sessions, whatever it was, you know, and I came out and I go into this thing thinking, well, I'm going to be fixed. And then,
yeah.
The VA center where I was going to, it was an older center. Thankfully, they built a new one here in Savannah. But, you know, basically this telehealth was sort of a ad hoc thing that they just came up with. And I remember, like, my first 3 sessions, I was almost like, I think it was a broom closet is where I was at.
I've seen that in some places. I've seen some really great ones, and then I've seen some, yeah, that's kind of start that program in a closet.
You know, and again, I get it. They're trying, you know, the individuals are trying to do with what they can, you know, and with that too, I mean, I've got an incredible primary care provider at the VA. She is just top notch, and I'm so thankful that, you know, that's just, you know, who I got selected, to have. And so, and again, there's other people I've had at the VA that, in fact, on a personal level, individual level, I've had good care at the VA, but as a system, as a program, yeah, I definitely, you know, also see the challenges. And, you know, just like what I was saying, I mean, I was in a broom closet and asked to share my deepest, darkest secrets. And
with a total stranger,
yeah,
over a TV
tough.
Set.
Was that one of your first, programs?
Yeah, actually it was.
Yeah. That would make it tough, too.
It's like a hard way to get it off the ground.
Yeah.
Right.
I've had people say, like, the Chico Clinic was the first one really to do much telehealth that I was aware of, and people said, I could attack it. You know, a lot of these guys were older, and, you know, they're kind of grumpy anyway, but I was like, I'm not going to go talk to somebody on a TV set. That's
what are you
ridiculous.
Saying?
I learned everything I learned from you, Bill.
Okay.
So they were kind of grumpy about it, but then I go to a thing that's monthly down there, and they said, well, how's that telehealth thing going? And the guy's like, you know, I kind of like it.
Right.
So there are some people that sort of grows on them, and they do have access to people that they wouldn't have access to in their own community. I sort of think about it like back when we were in Catholic school and we had to go to confession, and my brother was an altar boy, and so he never wanted the priest to know it was him.
He changed his voice.
So he could go in there and he'd bless me, Father, for I've sinned. He'd throw this weird little girl voice. You could hear him all over the whole church. Okay, so in another respect, I mean, they're going to see these people in their community, so maybe telehealth is kind of nice. I mean, you're arm's length.
Yeah.
You're not going to run into these folks in the grocery store, so it's, you know, and you don't have to talk like a little girl.
You know, the situation we're in right now, right? I mean, those are not essential services, I'm 99% sure. And so, you know, that's really the only option for a lot of medical services right now, including counseling.
Yeah. They're using it for that. Yeah, you can't go join your group now.
And the VA is not the only place using telehealth either. So that's kind of important for people to know. We have to take another really quick break, and then we'll be back with our guest, Matt Rogge. And you can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us if you happen to be listening on Sunday, March 29th, 2020. On or about 12:30, and you can find a chat room window there. Otherwise, sorry, it's closed. Be right back.
What I felt was right, like a rock. Like a rock. I was strong as I could be, like a rock. Nothing ever got to me, like a rock. I was something to see, like a like a rock. My old man's that old man, spent his life living off the land. Dirty hands and a clean soul. It breaks his heart seeing foreign cars filled with fuel it isn't ours. And wearing
there is no more timely a song. First, we're chatting with you, and, well, you know, all the rest of it. So, Matt, what's the thing that'll get people out of sort of that denial? I see a lot of guys. I see ladies who, so just veterans in general, and I see them oftentimes not get any kind of help until, you know, they've been arrested, they've been kicked out of their family's house, they can't, you know, just really bad stuff has already happened, and they've spiraled down mm-hmm. really far.
Yeah, that's, you know, sort of the magic question, I think, because, you know, I mean, if somebody's just, you know, they've got to want to be helped,
yeah.
And, you know, and I get it, you know, that can sound like a trite thing to say, but, you know, because they carry a lot of guilt. I mean, there's times where, you know, guilt can overwhelm me, but just that idea that, you know, just praying that they're able to hear somebody at some point say something that's going to cause them to go, huh, maybe I need to look into something else. I need to help myself before they hit the bottom, because, you know, without them, without education, to some extent, you know, but I mean, ultimately somebody's going to have to make that decision. I mean, even if they have people who love them, you know, intervening on their behalf, ultimately the person's still going to have to make that choice, for what that looks like at some point.
Sure.
And hopefully that's going to happen before, like you said. I mean, it's, I've met lots of different vets who, like you said, they hit rock bottom mm-hmm. and that can end up with, you know, destroyed marriages.
Yeah. I left that one out. I forgot. That's usually kind of the first casualty of the whole deal.
Yeah. You know, jail time.
Yeah. Drugs.
Drugs, all those things. And it's horrible. And
then they have more things, you know, to kind of, you know, then when the alcohol and drugs all take over, then you have to deal with that too. So it's kind of a multifaceted problem. There are a lot of programs. I don't know. Tell me out in your area. Do you guys have all these different kind of things like fishing and, I mean, I know you fish out there, but do you have programs for veterans that like are about fishing? They do a lot of those programs and horse, equestrian type programs.
There are, I haven't come across too many in our area, you know, as far as, you know, within something that I would be able to do, you know, within a day. I know that they're, you know, around here on the East Coast.
But not, like, not super local. Same, too, with like training service dogs. I know there's a program for training service dogs, and that seems to kind of get people out without it being a group thing where we're all going to talk about a problem. It's more focused on an activity.
Right. And I think, I mean, because those are great, and that's how I sort of, how I really started to come to grips with my, I guess, you know, really identifying, all right, what's going on in my head and what are some steps I can start taking forward, was going on one of these, just an activity trip. It's called the Tadpole Foundation, and it's actually based out of California, down in the San Diego area. And we went, it was last summer, I did a trip to Montana, a backpacking outdoor trip. It was an incredible experience. I'm actually going to talk about it next week on my show. but it was this, there was no group sessions, there was no kumbaya moment. There was a couple times to where some of the more experienced, there was a couple people that had been on the trip before, and they sort of, you know, facilitated some small discussion, but there was never a time to where, all right, we're all going to sit around and, like you said, talk about the things that scare us.
Mm-hmm.
Those things came up, they just organically, just, you know, you're out in the wilderness, just talking, getting to know each other, and that's when I was like, wow, you know, these people are like me, even though
sure.
we had completely different experiences in combat.
But the same kind of result, and you were in for 22 years. So
yeah.
you have
mm-hmm.
people who were in for 4 years, 40 years ago. You've got people, you know, all different time spans, and yet the result tends to be very much the same. Tell me this, when you came back, how long before you started doing the missionary work?
I think my last deployment was the end of 2008, and then retired year and a half later, and we went overseas. So it was probably about 2 years from the time I came back from a planned trip.
It
was about 2 years.
Like, was it something you were planning on doing? I mean, have you been involved in that before? I really basically know nothing about your life, so I just know Lisa.
it was something. I mean, we'd done some short term trips before. As individuals to different countries around the world, and we've gone as a family, did some stuff here in the United States, and so probably starting in about 2007, I began to, my wife and I were talking about what might be next, and so we started to talk about, all right, you know, ministry looked like something that would be something that I would want to do post-military, whenever that might be. Then as time progressed, that began to get more concrete as far as when we were going to make that decision, ultimately make that transition.
That's cool. And where'd you guys wind up going? Didn't see.
We were over in the Mediterranean on the island of Cyprus.
Oh. Well, that's kind of neat. I mean, was that somewhere you were ever, if you can tell us, is that somewhere you were ever deployed? I mean, why'd you pick that?
No, never deployed there. Never deployed there.
We don't want any black helicopters this morning because, you know, I'm sure they're all busy doing other things, probably delivering face masks.
right. I mean, pretty close. You know, I mean, I think we were within 50 miles. We could see Turkey from where we live, which, again, I mean, they're, you know, NATO ally.
Yes.
And then we can talk for a long time about that, right?
Do you have your fingers crossed behind your back?
That's right. You know, but pretty close to Lebanon as well, and, you know, different parts of that area. But, yeah, I mean, there was definitely, as far as from a physical standpoint, I mean, Cyprus was just incredibly beautiful.
That's kind of awesome. And you, and how long did you stay there? Oh, 2 years. Wait, I'm looking at your thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like a short-term, you know, gig. It wasn't one of those, you know, we took a week and went there. You stayed there for two solid years.
Yeah. I mean, the plan, we didn't really, it was sort of an open-ended decision when we went over there. And, I mean, we pretty much sold everything. It was sort of like Cortez when he got to America burning
burned the boats.
I mean, you know, we still owned our house, but we got rid of everything else. We rented out the house, and everything we owned other than our suitcases fit in a 5x5 storage unit that we left here in Georgia and took off.
And you stored some stuff in a 5x5. That's not a lot of room.
No, that isn't. So we've increased our amount of stuff that we have now. Sometimes I say unfortunately, but, you know. So, you know, that was what we did. I mean, looking back on it, both my wife and I, we wouldn't trade it for the world, but at the same time, again, hindsight being 20/20, I mean, we did it because, you know, we believed in it. We believed, you know, we're followers of Jesus, and we wanted to do it for that reason, you know, but there were some other things going on there, too, as far as wanting to leave the military behind and some of the things that, again, for my head, I'm going to divest myself of that identity for a while.
Right.
And
yeah, that would certainly change your, I mean, that's, I mean, I'm sure there are other radical changes you could have done, but I mean, that's
right.
Pretty big change.
Right. Yeah. You know, and so probably not the most healthy choice. And I don't see, you know, and that wasn't the reason I made it. But at the same time, it's made me who I am today. And, again, we wouldn't trade it for the world. We still do work. I'm still working in ministry. So, you know, it's a good thing.
That's cool. And now how much of, like with your podcast, is this kind of like a mix of all of it? Is it veteran-centric or is it mission-centric or yes, just all of it?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah. You know, and again, I'm learning as I go. We've published 3 episodes. We've recorded 7. And so, you know, right now I'm just sort of talking about stuff that's been on my heart for a long time. And I've interviewed a few people. You know, I've got plans to interview more people and some other things I want to do with it. But as you can imagine, I'm sure when you guys started the radio show, you were like, what am I going to do with this? And you had some ideas initially, and then eventually you started to evolve into.
Yeah, then it's like tidal wave time. All of a sudden, there are too many people, too many ideas, in a good way. Not enough time. I think that's awesome. So the website for that is thrivingonmission.com, where mm-hmm. Matt's podcast is. And we have to take yet another break. Do you have to take breaks in podcasts, or do you get to just keep talking?
We can just keep talking.
Oh, man, I'm so jealous. brief interruption. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
All gave some. Some gave all, and some stood through for the red, white, and blue, and some had to fall. And if you ever think of me, think of all your liberties and recall. Some gave all. Sorrow in the distance, I'm gonna trust and cast my fears aside. My life's a work that I know you'll finish. I know I'm gonna be alright. It's you I'll chase, even when I can't see your face. No matter how many skies fall down, I'm covered under the peace I've found. You're my shelter when there's no.
So no pressure, but in the last 10 minutes, what haven't we covered? Go ahead and cram it all in.
Wait, what was the question?
You have 10 minutes. Go.
Go. Right. Right. And one thing I do want to say, too, is as we're going, because we talk a lot about post-traumatic stress and mm-hmm. what can people do right now, and I'll say this again, the PTSD Foundation of America has a hotline. It's 877-717-7873, and that number is actually, it will be picked up by a combat vet, somebody who has been through probably what they're doing, you know, going through, and you know, and they'll talk to them. And so I think, you know, if anybody's struggling at some point, you know, pick up the phone, make that call.
That's awesome. I will list that on the website, PTSD Foundation of America.
Yep. Mm-hmm. The website is ptsdusa.org.
Thank you. That's what I was just looking up. All right. Who runs it? Is it a foundation?
Yeah, it's a private foundation. They've got one of their big things is they have a facility in Texas called Camp Hope, and it's an in-treatment facility. Not for in treatment as far as to deal with strong levels of addiction, but it's the minimum of a 5-month in treatment program that they do. And wow. It's no cost at all for the veterans. And I was actually talking to somebody from their program last week, getting some information for somebody else. And, you know, basically, you know, if the guy or gal is having trouble, you know, they call, they, you know, get in touch with somebody, and then a combat vet, somebody who's gone through the program, this at Camp Hope, will give them a call, and they start walking them through. And basically all they need to have is copy their DD-214, something that says that they've got post-traumatic stress, whether that's from the VA, from the e-benefits page, or just a doc, or, and even then, they can probably work through something, and then a copy of their photo ID, and then they work on getting them a plane ticket to Texas.
I was just going to ask that. How do they get there?
They fly.
That's pretty awesome, but they will do that. So if you have somebody who doesn't have resources.
Yeah, exactly. And they're still taking patients, I'm sure they don't call them patients, but they're still taking vets right now. And they've got a program in place to isolate them a little bit, you know, for the first week or two. I can't remember what it is, but, you know, they haven't shut off the spigot right now.
Wow. That's awesome.
How many vets can they handle?
I'm not sure. I mean, it looks, you know, that's about as much as I know about it, about the story. I know I've met a couple people that have gone through Camp Hope, and, you know, these two individuals spoke incredibly high of the program and, you know, what they were able to accomplish while they were there.
That's fantastic. Boy, too bad I didn't know about that about a year ago. I guess, you know, you have to get them on the plane. You've got to get them there.
Right.
And
right.
I had a mom with two sons, and the one son was just spiraling out of control. And there was a lot of alcohol involved and that sort of thing. And ultimately wound up being just a huge blowout in the family. I mean, it was just it really got bad. And his brother wound up shooting him in self-defense.
Oh, man.
So, and they tried everything. But
heartbreaking.
He was just not in a place where he really wanted to fix it. He would have had to have been convinced by someone, and it just didn't click for him. But we lose people like that all the time, and so there's a whole family. He's got one child, maybe two. So he was the one who had kids. The other brother, of course, has to live with that, and the mom mom obviously lost her son, and what a terrible waste. But it was one of those that, you know, he was having trouble at work, got fired from a job, got hired again later, having some trouble. So he went through several jobs. It was a kind of a slow devolving that went on, and I'm sure that's not unusual.
Right. You know, I mean, stories like that, I mean, again, you could probably just change just a little bit of that narrative, and it could fit so many other stories out there.
Yep.
And it's just so heartbreaking.
But for those people, I mean, this foundation, because, you know, we tried, I sent her to, you know, some of the VA inpatient stuff, and he didn't want to go, and that's a whole different deal. This would be a completely different thing than an inpatient facility for, you know, drugs or PTSD or whatever.
Right.
And especially if they had the opportunity to speak with someone, you know, didn't have to go anywhere, didn't have to sign up for anything, you know, just have a conversation. So for those folks out there that have people in that situation, yeah, what is it? PTSDUSA.org.
Yep.
That's fantastic. Thank you for that. We'll all be able to make use of that. So on your podcast, what are you going to focus on in the future? What do you have lined up for us? Because you already cut the shows, right?
So I've got, let's see. So I think seven shows are done now. And then, next week I'm talking about this other organization, Tadpole Foundation, which they focus on taking vets in the outdoors and again, just trying to re-identify them with, you know, that they can still do stuff. I've got a couple interviews. I've got one of my best friends who's still in the area. We served together for the entire time I was in the 160th. and we break down some myths about post-traumatic stress, and then just going to, one of the things I plan to do is I'm going to get my wife to come on the show, because I think...
Another perspective.
Good perspective, yeah.
Yeah, because as a spouse, you know, again, they are dealing with it as well, just in a different way. And there are programs out there for military spouses, too. So
yeah, because they have their own set of issues. And I would imagine, you know, there are some, not to make it too simplistic, but tips and tricks to deal with some of these things, because a lot of the issues are somewhat repetitive.
Exactly. You know, I know when my wife and I, one of the cool things, quick little vignette as we're getting ready to wrap up, we were seeing a counselor after we had come back from missionary service, and I had done something to where I shouldn't have said something, and I was exerting some unhealthy, you know, what it was, in a control. Like, I think if I remember right, I wanted to go somewhere one evening to where she was going to go hang out with some friends. Actually, I think it was a concert, like a church concert or something like that. And I was like, and I was just stressed. I wanted things within my control. And so we got into a big argument. About a week later, we were at our counselor, told her the story, and the counselor sort of looked at me and she goes, you know, Matt, these feelings that you have of anxiety and fear, you know, they're valid. You know, this idea that you want to control everything, these are valid feelings. And I remember I was sort of like puffing my chest out a little bit, like, oh, see?
Uh-huh.
It was okay for me to do those things. But then, and like not even half a breath later, she goes, but that doesn't give you the right to put that on your wife and son.
Yeah.
Ouch.
I would imagine the puffing stopped at that point.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but again, there's a lot of truth there, and that's probably one of the big things that I've learned how to do is to communicate with my wife of like, hey, things aren't good right now. Let me tell you what's going on,
mm-hmm.
and I'll be open, you know, and share a little bit, and then she knows to give me some space, and at the same time, I'm not going to lash out at her. So it's, you know, because there's times where, you know, I just need some room to myself, not necessarily to isolate in a bad way, but just, all right, take some breaths,
yeah,
whatever that might look like.
Well, see, and that's awesome, because there are a lot of people who haven't, I mean, if they could kind of practice that a little bit and they knew that would work, I think if people knew something would work, they would maybe do it more.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome. So people should definitely listen to your podcast. It's thrivingonmission.com. Our guest has been Matt Rogge. And thanks, Matt, for hanging with us.
Yeah. Thanks, Aaron. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you,
pleasure.
Matt.
And you guys enjoy the rest of your day.
Absolutely, you too. We'll be right back. Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. We are airing live on March 29th, 2020, but I'm sure we'll play the show again at some other time, so just enjoy it whenever you're listening to it. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. Pape Machinery is our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. They handle everything tractors, ag, and turf related. Go by and see them. And also pick up a Honda generator while you're there. They got lots on hand, and that season is right around
it's
the corner.
Fast approaching.
That's right. You're going to need one. So go by and see them, or give them a call at 226-9226, or get them on the web at pappymachinery.com.
And there you have it. So you can find everything about the program with 10 years of archives that are free for you to use as you like. They're commercial free and posted in MP3 format for you to listen to or send to a friend or do whatever you want with. And that is at wethepeopleradio.us. Okay, without further ado, we're going to move on to Sean Flanagan. which is kind of exciting. We're going to talk about something that, well, yet again, I mean, this isn't actually new information. Bill and I know nothing about this. We always bring on somebody we...
Well, I was just reading up on it last night.
You're a veritable expert. So, Sean Flanagan is the director of the Center for Metrics. Which already it's like, what?
What?
Yes. And he talks about the United States Prosperity Index. Oh, back in the game again. So first comprehensive assessment of all aspects of prosperity across America and how this has changed over time. Pretty interesting. I didn't know anybody was actually doing this. And he has a lot of years working in the UK in their government on statistical matters. And so obviously... very well qualified to tell us all about this, and we'll just be listening. We'll be here silently listening. Sean, how's it going?
Hi, Aaron. Very well. Hi, Bill. Great to be on. Thanks.
Hi, Sean.
Me.
Thanks for being on. We appreciate it.
So we'll just follow along. How would you like to start this whole thing?
Well, it might be helpful if I just sort of give a bit of a background about who we are. What on earth are we doing, doing a study on the U.S.? This might be in some of your listeners' minds.
Sure, that's
great. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Is that a good start? Okay, so I'm based at the Lagarten Institute. We're a global think tank based in London. Our mission, if you like, is to help create the pathways from poverty to prosperity. We've been in existence for about 13, 14 years. And we want to help create those pathways so that nations... and others can move from sort of poverty to prosperity. But when we talk about prosperity, I think there's often different definitions of prosperity, so it might be worthwhile just clarifying what we mean. We mean really a combination of both economic and social well-being. I think often prosperity can just be thought of in terms of wealth, but we think for a life to truly flourish, you need a combination of economic and social well-being. And we, at the Institute, have therefore been measuring and tracking prosperity across the globe for the past 13 years using our Global Prosperity Index. So we take in that global index, we take about 299 indicators and we create a very holistic measure of economic and social well-being. And when we look at the US in that index, what we find is the US performs particularly well, as you'd expect, on the economic aspects of the index. It's fourth overall in the globe on the economic aspects. But when we look at the other two domains, as we call them, we've got three domains in the index. Open economies is the first one. Second one is inclusive societies. And the third is empowered people. On the other two domains, inclusive societies and empowered people, the U.S. ranks 21st and 27th,
wow,
respectively. And that, therefore, when you look at overall prosperity in the U.S., it ranks 18th. Globally, which is still pretty high. The UK, I think, is at 11, so, you know, they're not too far apart. But there is something interesting around the sort of social well-being aspect that we wanted to understand in a bit more depth, which led us to do the study of the US, of the 50 states, and of DC in the United States Prosperity Index.
Well, I think people always, when they think of prosperity, they think of bank account. You know, bank account and money. So
yeah.
I think your index is much more valid because...
Yeah, it takes into account more than yeah, because...
It's what our parents always told us. Money doesn't make you happy.
Yeah, I think I'm prosperous, but Warren Buffett would probably starve on my budget. But so it's not all about the money.
And I'm curious now with all this global pandemic and businesses being closed everywhere and all that... does this sort of render a lot of your information somewhat obsolete, or is it a good predictor for the future?
I think this, I mean, it's a very good point there, and I think with the index, we're curating, if you like, data sources that are available within the U.S. So we've used all the data that's already published in the U.S. and brought that together into this index. So obviously that data is backward-looking. It looks at how things have been, and so the index, as we have it, and we'll be doing an update this summer, and we're for the first time also going from a state index to a county index for a number of states, and California is one of those states where we're going to be doing a deep dive into looking at the counties, because we're well aware, if you take the whole of the U.S. and then break that in into states, you'll see the disparities, but then if you take a state, particularly a large one like California, we know that when you unpack that, you'll see disparities in areas of high prosperity and areas of lower prosperity. So that's also publishing the summer. But to your point, absolutely. The index is very much looking using data to see how things have been and where we are now. Obviously, we are currently very live in this global pandemic, and that is going to have a big impact on many aspects of the index. So as we go forward and track that, we will absolutely see those things beginning to be reflected in the index. But we can also use it a little bit, particularly like the global one. We are looking at the sort of strength of healthcare systems in the index, and are we seeing certain nations being able to be more resilient, perhaps, and deal better with the COVID-19 than others. And when we look at likes of South Korea and Singapore, they seem to have actually been more resilient and not had the sort of impact that others are having. And in, another interesting one at the moment in Europe for us is Germany, which again is seeing far less than cases and also deaths than perhaps many other European countries. Again, it's interesting to try and understand. But these, as I'm sure you're aware, are very, very complex issues, and there's many, many factors that lead into what we're witnessing in individual countries at the moment.
So
the index is exactly backward-looking, but it can help inform a little bit how some nations might be able to or may respond.
So what are... probably the list is too long, but what are some of the criteria that you measure to come up with the index?
Like, what are things we would never think of? You have 299 options, so.
Well, I think the best way of thinking about it, I find this quite helpful, and you might find it helpful too in your listeners, is the index is a bit like a triangle or a pyramid. So at the very pinnacle at the top of the apex, you've got what is the overall prosperity of a place, be it a state or a nation. Underneath that, you've then got these three domains, open economies, inclusive societies, and empowered people. Mm-hmm. Underneath that, you've then got what we call the pillars of prosperity. And so in the US, we've got 11. In the global one, we've got 12. Three of those in the US relate to open economies. So that's, we measure open economies not necessarily just by the strength of output, but also what is the environment like for investment, for entrepreneurial activity, for investor protections, labor market flexibility. We then also look at the quality of the infrastructure, so that supports trade, enables trade. So that would be around communications, transport, resources. And the final part of the economic aspect is the economic quality. That is, how well prepared is a state to generate wealth sustainably?
And do you use the same ones for every country? Are they all the same?
Yes. What we did with the US is we did an exercise last year where we looked at our global one, and what we want to do with both the global and the US one is it to be informative for policymakers, to really help them set their agendas. So we went back to basics a little bit and re-refined the index, so it had these policy-focused elements. So, as I mentioned, you've got overall prosperity, you've got these three domains, you've got these 11 pillars of prosperity, and then underneath that in the US, you've got these 48 policy-focused elements. So they're really designed for policymakers to be able to see where perhaps they need to invest resources or where they're doing really well and to continue that strength. So a good example is, if we look at education, we've broken down education into different stages of education because we believe that's helpful. So if you look at pre-primary, primary, high secondary, sort of high school, and then tertiary. But then within that, we've looked at, well, what's the enrollment rate, what's the graduation rate, and what's the quality of the education that pupils are receiving through things like using indicators.
Fascinating,
on test scores.
Especially when you break it out by county, because as I'm sure you figured out, California has a huge range. I mean, up where we are, there's a county that's still considered frontier. So we've got heavy, heavy urban, suburban, you've got rural, and then we have frontier. So yeah. you should run the gamut. You picked a good state for that. We have to take a really quick break. We'll be back with our guest, Sean Flanagan. We have a great article posted on the website, American Prosperity Depends on States Being Laboratories of Democracy. And that was written by him and also by Stephen Bryan. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us. Our guest is Sean Flanagan, the director of the director for the Center for Metrics at a London-based think tank, which seems very far away. And so how would that impact anybody else? But you know what? This is really interesting. I didn't know anybody was out there. I guess there's always somebody doing something interesting. But we were talking on the break, Sean. We were curious. Once you kind of have done your research, do you plug in different policy decisions and give maybe estimations of how that would affect? Is that, or do you just give flat information to policymakers?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we want to be doing more in the policy space. And my background, and a number of others, including Stephen Bryan, who's the director of policy, spent many years in government here in the UK, and Stephen's worked in other governments around the world. My time in government was very much making sure that ministers and other officials had the right information to make the right policy choices. And then having made those choices, being able to measure and track how effective they were, you know, were they having the desired effect and impact. So we see the index as being absolutely something that can be used in two ways. One is to help inform the policy agenda. And then the second thing is around also being able to track whether things are getting better as a result of policies that have been put in place. And that's helpful for the general public as well, because they can use this index to help hold government to account. And are, you know, state governors and others, are they living up to the promises perhaps that they've made historically? So it works as both accountability tool, but also a policy-making tool.
That's interesting, and yet again, I think you're going to have a field day in California, because they've made a lot of really dumb decisions, not the least of which, especially now during this particular deal with the virus, they outlawed any private contractors. So, you know, people who would, say, deliver food, people who would, say, do in-home care for the elderly, nurses, traveling nurses that aren't assigned to a particular hospital, they're unable to work in this state because they have to be an employee of a business. They cannot be a contract.
Yeah.
So, like I said, I think you're going to have a really, really good time looking at that data. Tell us, You've already done all 50 states. Have you already finished all this research, or are you kind of in the throes of it?
No, so we did the first publication last year, 2019, the U.S. Prosperity Index. So that all of this information, I should say, Aaron and Bill, are freely available on our website, which is usprosperity.net. You've got the report there. You've got an interactive map that gives you a state profile for each of the states and DC, and that presents everything. That pyramid structure that I talked you through is there for each state. It's in PDF form, and you can really drill down to see where your state is doing well and where it's not doing so well. As I say, full disclosure, we really want this information to be used.
So, I think it's great. It's really easy to use, too, because the states are all just right there. You just click on them, and off you go.
We've tried. And this year we're doing a refresh of the state index. That's going to be published in July. We're also designing a more interactive website. And as I mentioned, we're doing a county index for eight states, one of which is California. The reason why we're only doing eight is I think there's about 3,140 counties across the U.S., so that's a major undertaking to do it all. But you know, if there's interest by others, then that's something that we may be able to do. But we are a charity, so we're reliant on people to sort of support our work.
Sure.
And so we'll be publishing that in July, which we're excited about as well. So it'll be an update of the state index and the first edition of the county prosperity index.
So with this information, how long will it be before we can tell if prosperity is going up or down in the United States?
At the moment, so when we published the report last year, and we see this in the global index as well, so obviously in the global index we see the U.S. as a whole, and then in the state index we see how the 50 states and D.C. contribute to that. So what we've done is we've taken the global taxonomy and said, okay, how does this apply to the U.S.? And we had about 35 to 40 U.S. experts, advisors on this as well. So these are people in the U.S. who are education experts, health experts. We had about three or four experts per each of the 11 pillars, and they really helped to shape the taxonomy and then also advised us on which indicators we should use as a sort of proxy for capturing that aspect. That demonstrated that prosperity in the U.S. Has been rising and has continued to rise and is its highest ever level. This is when we published last year. Obviously, as a result of what's going on now, not just in the U.S. but across the world, we are undoubtedly going to see the impact of that coming through in the index. But you know, it would probably take a little while to feed through.
Yeah, because that's really going to be, I mean, in the big picture, it's almost a false indicator of what's really going on once people go back to work and things, you know.
Yeah, level out. We find out who made it and who didn't make it.
Right.
Well, it looks like right now that you have in the U.S. anyway, the states that are kind of the most prosperous by your index are really the New England states. They seem to be doing quite well.
Sorry. Yeah. So when you look at the map, predominantly the states that sort of top the index are generally a number of them are in the sort of, you know, the northeast up the top. But you do have a number of other states across the U.S. which also do well. So you've got the likes of Washington State, Utah, Colorado, Minnesota as well. But there is a clustering in the sort of northeast,
and you kind of have there's also kind of a clustering in the south as well. Oklahoma, Arkansas, Missouri, Tennessee, Kentucky are all in the bottom percentile. Also with New Mexico and Nevada. I'm surprised about Nevada. Nevada's always, I don't know, seemed like they were always doing really well.
Well, it did see, when we look at the change over the past decade, it has actually, it was the 13th most improved state. So it had actually made a number, you know, it had made a number of improvements over the past decade. So it probably does speak to your point around, being improved. But all of these indicators in here that we've curated and pulled together, they're mainly a sort of administrative or objective measures. So, you know, things like number of people with health insurance, for example. But we do also try to capture some satisfaction measures as well, because we think they're important, because people's prosperity is not just a sort of direct measure. It is also a measure of how they are feeling about certain aspects of their life. So when we look at mental health, for example, which is one of the health elements, we do look at mental health because that is a really important part of overall health.
And how do you measure that? Or where does the data come for that?
So the data on mental health, I'm just going to quickly go to the state profile that I've got the California one open. So we have a number of measures, and actually mental health was a challenge to do. Not necessarily so much when we looked at the U.S., because I think the U.S., because it's a highly developed nation, has a good understanding of mental health, where it was a particular challenge in the global index, where a lot of nations, for example, they don't, the concept of mental health is not really that well understood.
No, they're busy feeding people. They haven't mastered hunger yet, so they haven't moved on to mental health,
some cases,
I would imagine.
Yes. And often, people who have mental health issues perhaps are just labeled as being, you know, maybe mad or something, and there isn't necessarily that care or support. So trying to capture data accurately is always a challenge, but we really believe that. So in the US, though, for example, we've got in the mental health element, which forms part of the overall health, there are five indicators. So we've got suicide, we've got drug overdose deaths, we've got serious mental illness, we have disability-weighted prevalence from mental illness, which is what's known as the Bally's measure. And then to what I was just talking about then, we have self-reported mental health not good. Now, there's about four different sources that they come from. What we do with the index is we at the very lowest level of the pyramid I was talking about earlier, we've got about 215 indicators. Those then cluster together to create these policy focus elements. Then they're added together to do the pillars, which are added together to domain, to added together to do overall prosperity. So the indicators and the elements, we weight. They are weighted. Everything starts off with a weight of one, and then we up or down weight it based on statistical analysis, but also subjective judgment based particularly on drawing upon our experts, our US experts, to get a sense of how important are these things to measuring certain aspects. So that's the mental health. It's made up of those five indicators.
Well, see, and that explains a lot of the bright red states in, like Louisiana came in 50th, and they've had huge problems with the opioid epidemic. So I would imagine that that pulled them down tremendously.
Yes, when we look at the states at the bottom, and also those at the top. Actually, one of the key findings we found, I mentioned one already of the study, is that overall prosperity across the U.S. has continued to rise as in its highest level. We had some macro messages that came out from the study. We had one which was that mental health has seen a deterioration over the past couple of decades, past decade. We had also that, actually I'll pause there because I'll go on to say what I was going to say. So that mental health overall across the U.S. has seen a decline, and particularly because of the increase in the drug overdose death, the opioid death. I mean, that, you know, as you will know better than me, the overall statistics for the U.S. are quite, you know, are quite shocking in a way that sort of 70,000 people a year are dying as a result of this. And that's higher apparently in 1 year, as I understand it, than armed forces personnel died in the whole of the Vietnam War. You know, this is a huge number of people. And we do see that a number of states, in fact, lots of states have seen a deterioration in that particular indicator. But when we look at the southern states, the ones that are towards the bottom of the index,
Hold that thought, Sean. Hold that thought. So before we delve into that, because I don't want to cut you off partway, I'm just going to cut you off now. Sorry. So we have to take a quick break. We'll be back with our guest, Sean Flanagan. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Sean, back to you. So talk to us about the southern states. You were going to give us some insight there.
Yeah, it was just when we look at the third domain, the empowered people domain, and that's made up of living conditions. So is that, do people have enough to live on? Or, you know, do they have adequate accommodation? Do they have access to sort of water services, those kind of things? And is the environment in which they live safe? So in terms of their work environments, their sort of home environment and things. We then have education, which I've sort of talked to already. Health as well is the other pillar. And then the fourth pillar in empowered people is the natural environment. So that's the extent to which the emission of sort of gases, the quality of the air, and then also the quality of the forest land and soil, and the preservation efforts that are being put in place to try and preserve the, you know, the land, etc., for future generations. So when we look at those four things combined, we actually see that those at the bottom, towards the bottom of the index, they generally perform the poorest on all four of those, and then those at the top of the index generally perform, you know, the best. It's quite interesting when you look at that sort of polarization across. But we don't see that. One of the other key macro findings of the study was we don't see that across the board. So if you look at our global index, those at the top of the index generally perform well on all 12 pillars, and those at the bottom generally perform poorly on all 12 pillars. When we look at the US, that's not the case, and that's one of the things that led us to that, this idea that, that sense that the state laboratories of democracy, because every single state has an opportunity to improve in one or more pillars, irrespective of where they land in the rankings table. And that creates this opportunity for where one state is perhaps not performing as well, another state that's performing stronger. Is there an opportunity for shared learning there? So can they look to see what that state doing, and could they perhaps replicate that or do something similar to help improve their score, their prosperity in that particular area?
Do you also highlight things they should stop doing?
Well, I think we're wrestling a little bit with the color coding that we use in the index, because we're quite aware that this sort of idea of green to red, sort of indicating sort of warning, danger kind of thing is perhaps sometimes a little bit misinterpreted. But what we're trying to do there is to sort of showcase where things are being done well and where things, areas that could improve. And, we can all improve on something. And I think through what the index helps show is where each state is, where they're not doing so well and where could improvement, be made. And that's what we want the index to be used for.
I think that's a great idea. And so I'm curious. So as you move from, say, the United States to Canada or to another country, do you do this for a bunch of other countries?
We're doing it for Africa at the moment. As I mentioned earlier, we're a charity, and so have a core funding, which has always funded our Global Prosperity Index, and that's something that we do every year, and we use that index to go and work with nations, and we are working with some nations at the moment where we're just trying to help them take the index and apply it to help improve and move forward. But the US work was actually funded by an organization called the Helmsley Charitable Trust. So they're sort of in South Dakota, and their interest is mainly health. They do a lot of work on health, and when they first approached us, they were mainly interested in doing some form of health index. But as we had a conversation with them, I think we talked through the aspects that many things impact health outcomes. So social determinants of health, so often living conditions, their environment, their education, their material resources, all of those things can impact health. And so as we carried on the conversation, they actually felt that it would be better for us to do a prosperity index. And when we looked across what was in the US already, and there's obviously a huge amount of data and information in the US, we found that there were many indexes on economic prosperity. You've got rich states, poor states, and you look at the social aspects, you've got the social progress index. But there wasn't really anything that brought the two together. So we felt that there was an opportunity to create a holistic measure of prosperity, which led us to do that study.
And do you find in other nations, I'm assuming a lot of this information you gather is public information, but is there a lot of private information that goes into this that nations may or may not be willing to give you?
No. I mean, all of the data that we have in both our global and U.S. index are publicly available data. We do use some data that we purchase. So we use some of the Gallup data, which is Gallup World Poll. Gallup, as you may know, a sort of large survey organization that conducts surveys worldwide as well as in country, and we pay for some of their data in the index. But we don't do any of our own primary data collection. We're using sort of reliable sources that, such as the World Bank, IMF, international organizations that pull this data together. So credibility is really important to us in terms of the data that we use. And that's the other thing I think that we bring, which is it's a sort of impartiality. We have no, hidden agenda, or we're in the US, we're nonpartisan. We don't have any particular, side to bat for, as it were. So there's a kind of objectivity and impartiality that we can bring with our index that perhaps others in, struggle with, and particularly in nations where the quality of data within the country is often questioned, and we can come with something that gives an objective and truthful measure, we believe, of what's actually going on.
Well, and, anyone who's taken a statistics statistics class knows, it's all in how you show the data. So having somebody who's impartial, who's not part of the political machinery, doesn't have an axe to grind, isn't trying to come out to a foregone conclusion, that's pretty rare. And I think you provide a valuable service.
Yes, that's what we want to do. Is we almost, if you like, let the data do the talking. And you know, the tool is not a sufficient measure in itself, but it provides the foundation, the basis from which you can build upon. So you obviously need to use local knowledge and expertise as well to help kind of provide added color to what you're seeing through the index. But the beauty of the index is that it provides a data-driven approach. So sometimes people will do things because they have a sort of gut feel or an instinct. And I think, you know, sometimes that can be good. Sometimes, actually, that can be misguided. And to use the index to help sort of say, okay, well, how are things now and then how have they changed, can then provide the platform to be able to help you decide on what further action needs to be taken.
Well, in the U.S., we're always being bludgeoned by, you know, these groups that are talking about income inequality, and that's all they ever focus on is income inequality. As you look at the results that you've drawn from this index, do you think there's a case to be made for that?
So what we do in the index is we actually look at that's in the living conditions pillar. We've got something called material resources as one of the elements. Mm. There, we look at the extent to the resources that people have. So it's sort of trying to capture those at the end of the spectrum that actually don't have sufficient. So through the index, we're trying to, rather than looking at those that have enough, we sort of do it the other way around, and then so you're negatively scored if you have a high proportion, for example, that are living below the national poverty line. So every country has their own measure of poverty, and we capture that in the index. And we do that at state level as well, so you can see what's the percentage of people who are living below that poverty line. So if there is a high proportion, then yes, you will be negatively scored.
Hmm. Interesting. And can you look at, I haven't been able to delve into your site deeply, but can you look at could you look at the whole country just on that index, or is it all taken as a totality?
So you can, in the global index, you can look at the whole of the US. So the global index provides the sort of what's happening across the US as a whole. But then the US prosperity index looks at how does that translate into the 50 states and DC. But I think I may be wrong. I need to check because it's a while since I looked. I think we do also create a overall. So we've got the U.S. prosperity index for each of the 50 states and D.C. I think we create one of these profiles for the U.S. as a whole as well.
Interesting. Well, I'm just curious because we have a lot of policy that winds up being driven by emotion. And, I mean, I'm sure every other country has that, too. But, bottom line is if you're doing well, if you have a job and you're not living on the street or whatever, then because you have those things, other people are living on the street, which obviously anyone who thinks about it knows that's not true. We could all go live on the street and that wouldn't help anybody. So I think it's really important, and especially in California, I think that's going to be great if you look at each county individually, because I think it's going to be surprising for a lot of people. It's interesting with this pandemic because there are people trapped in big cities. We're all looking at it, trapped in big cities, and they're the ones with the big outbreak because they're all jammed in there together. And I think that at least here, the prevailing sentiment has been that, you know, it's better to live in a big city. We live out in the rural part of the state up in the north. And, you know, that we're, you know, kind of hillbillies. What are we doing up here? And now, yeah. Now we're kind of looking at it, going, oh, it's good to be us.
You know. Well, I'm living in central London at the moment. You know, with pretty much lockdown. So,
So you're in the sucks to be you category. We're sorry about
Although
that.
We are still allowed to go out, and we're allowed to go out and have one form of exercise a day. So I was able to go along a nice long walk with my wife today along the river and back. So we're not completely housebound, but. It's pretty restricted.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Depending on where you are, we're getting into that weird space as well. We have to take a really quick break, and then we're going to come back. I can't believe it's gone so fast, darn it. So, Sean, when we come back with you, you know, all the things we forgot to ask you or that you wanted to share, it's totally you when we come back. So our guest is Sean Flanagan. Okay. You're listening to We the People Radio, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Although it's a great song, this isn't just about money, as we've learned. It's a whole index.
That's right.
It's a whole big index. So wealth isn't just money. Okay, so Sean, what have we, obviously you do this for a living, so we've missed a lot since we've only been hanging out with you now for like 40 minutes, but what do you think people should know and what can they learn from going maybe to your Institute webpage, which is li.com? Am I right? Looks almost too simple. Yeah, lookoutaminstitute.com, so li.com. What else do people need to know? Uh-oh. We have him in the cone of silence. Sean is living in the cone of silence. We told him he could have the whole rest of the time all himself. And then the call dropped, so...
Yeah.
Well,
there you have it. I was curious to know who was at the top of the index.
Countries.
Which countries, were at the top. I was surprised that the United States wasn't up there.
Well, I was curious if they ranked, if they when you said how they weight things, do they weight them for that place? Because comparing, like, the U.S., to Africa, comparing Europe to the U.S.
Yeah, I think he said that you know you can't compare
an
open
that.
Economy to a country that doesn't have an open economy.
Oh, so forgot about that too.
They change the criteria to come up with a more.
Well, and then some of the places don't really. Well, like you could never do China because they don't give you any data, and what they do give you is fake. On a brief commercial note, one interesting thing that's happening during this pandemic, for those of you who are Second Amendment supporters, here's a brief Second Amendment update. Very interesting. There are a lot of our brethren out there who thought they never needed a firearm because what would they do with it? And the police are there to protect them, so they don't need it. That's silly. Very interesting. There are a lot of people who are super frustrated that they cannot find firearms on the internet.
Yeah, they can't buy online.
Yeah, they can't buy them online.
When did that happen?
Yeah, so that's been a lie. Oh, and the gun show loophole. Whoops, that's not there either.
And how come you got to wait 10 days?
I know.
I mean, what's that? When did that happen?
Just in case you thought the whole thing was a complete waste of time, there are some interesting educational things happening. Okay, Sean's back.
Yeah.
Right. Hello. Sorry.
Hey, there he is.
No worries. Well, we kind of gypped you now, but we're curious. Like, what things do people need to know? They can go to li.com and learn things, I'm sure.
They can, or they can actually go to the dedicated U.S. website, which is usprosperity.net, and they can get a profile on their individual state, and they can, you know, look at how the state's performing across the different 11 pillars of prosperity, and then unpick that even further. So, I mean, one of the things that might be worthwhile is just giving a bit of an overview of California, given that's where we are, and might be helpful for listeners based on, I don't know, would that help?
Sure.
Yeah.
Because people have to hear about California, even if they don't live there, they have to hear about it all the time, so we might as well throw it out there.
Absolutely. So when we look at California, it actually sits pretty much bang in the middle of the index. So it's 24th out of 51. But interestingly, like the rest of the U.S., it's seen an improvement in its prosperity over the past decade, but it's actually outperformed the U.S. as a whole and has therefore risen up the rankings 8 places. So 10 years ago, it was 32nd. It's now 24th. So it's had quite a sort of meteoric rise over that time. And it's seen pretty much an improvement across the board. So the open economies domain has seen a big improvement. It's moved up 12 places on that particular aspect. And in particular, it's the economic quality where there's biggest improvement. So it's gone up 28 ranking places in the rankings, up to 6th place now. And economic quality is made up of a number of different things. One is around fiscal sustainability, so that's the extent to which the state can support itself in the event of a sort of crisis in terms of, federal reserves and how many days, etc., what's the sort of budget to expenditure or expenditure to income ratio. We then look at dynamism. This is the extent to which new businesses are being attracted, so entrepreneurship, startups, are they surviving? It's actually ranked first on that particular aspect. So it has actually seen quite a big improvement on a number of the different aspects of economic quality. The one area where it hasn't improved so much is around labor force engagement. So this looks at the extent to which the workforce is sort of active in the employment arena. So we look at adult unemployment, youth unemployment. We look at things like labor force participation. So the youth unemployment in California is still reasonably high. It's at 9.3%. And also the labor force participation, it's seen a slight deterioration there. So on that particular element, it's still ranking 43rd. So whilst it's seen an improvement in a number of those particular areas of economic quality, that's one area where it hasn't. And then we also see an improvement in governance. Governance looks at the extent to which a state is sort of well-managed, political accountability, rule of law. And the rule of law has seen an improvement. So that measures things around the transparency of the judiciary, you know, the fairness of the judiciary. It's moved up 12 places in the rankings. And on government integrity, it's actually moved up from 42nd in the rankings to 16th. And that's particularly we see around reductions in certain aspects of corruption. Corruption measures have improved. And then as we move into the empowered people domain, we see that health in California, where it ranks 4th at the moment overall out of 52, so 51, so it does particularly well. Behavioral risk factors, so that's where we look at aspects of health that are sort of indications of that there are, you know, health is an issue. So we look at things like obesity, we look at smoking, we look at sort of high use of alcohol and sort of drugs as well. But California ranks 2nd there. So there are other aspects of health. I'm slightly conscious of time. But in terms of improvements, if we just look at those quickly, there are a certain number of the pillars. So market access and infrastructure, where California ranks 43rd. When you look across the different elements, we look at things like communication. So things around like internet access, high-speed internet access in particular, and ultra-fast internet availability, it doesn't do quite so well.
No, because we have lots of areas that still don't have that.
No, exactly. And I think that's a particular challenge for the state. And so, yeah, that's why it sort of doesn't score as well. The resources aspect particularly looks at the availability, supply, and reliability of electricity. And again, that's where we see in California it's not doing as well as other states. And then the final aspect is transport, so the infrastructure. So it seems to have sort of good bus route coverage, but when you look at the availability and access to roads and the quality of those roads and bridges, not as good as other states. So it actually, that's why it comes out of 43rd. Social capital is one of those areas which we haven't talked about, which is very interesting, and this is almost like the glue which holds society together. So this is the strength of relationships, personal, family, friends, but also trust in institutions, trust in each other. And also the extent to which people participate and engaged in the civic society, so volunteering, sort of members of religious organizations and also non-religious organizations, sports and social clubs and things. It's 44th California for overall for social capital. But then the one area that we sort of touched on a little bit, which might be good to finish on, is living conditions. So there, where we're looking at the extent to which people have enough resources, they have sort of, availability of good water services, but they also have connectedness. Again, that's another area where we measure things like internet access and availability, rural, urban broadband. The one area where I think that pulls California down to 38 on living conditions is around the shelter aspect, and that's where we measure things like available affordable housing, homelessness, the sort of rough sleeping, overcrowding. It probably doesn't come as a surprise that, California overall,
depending on where you are, that's
on that one.
Yeah, it's kind of a mushroom cloud at this point, depending on the city.
Yeah. But when you look at California state as a whole, and there are obviously pockets where, San Francisco, I believe has quite high levels of homelessness. And so, but when you spread that out across the state, it comes out 51st on that element. So there's a number of areas I've talked through very rapidly there, Bill and Erin, that I've sort of where California's doing well, but there are also a number of areas where it could improve. And, there is so much more that the index and the state profile can tell people about California. So just encourage people to go and have a look.
Oh, yeah. And so when do you think your county assessment will be available?
We should be publishing it around the end of July.
Oh,
obviously,
wow.
With things currently at the moment, we were hoping to be able to get out to the U.S. In fact, I was due back there. We did a two-week tour of the sort of East Coast, as it were, cutting across to Atlanta and Texas. We were coming back, and we were going to start in California, go into sort of Colorado, and then go up to Montana at the end of April. That, unfortunately, has all been put on hold. But we're very hopeful to get back out there as soon as we can. We're keen to get out there to engage with people, promote the index.
Because at this point, you're lucky to just get out and walk your dog.
Exactly.
Much less tour the U.S.
Yeah. Hey, Sean, real quick, who's number one? What country is probably the highest on the index?
Bill, you're killing me.
Oh, on the global one?
Yes.
On the global one, it's Norway.
Norway.
Canadian countries.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Well, my only song that has any kind of British flavor was the Pink Panther, so I guess we thought we'd play that on your outgoing.
I love the Pink Floyd song Money, though, as well. That's a great thing. So.
I thought that was useful. Thank you, Mr. Sean Flanagan
from
the
Legatum
Institute. We really appreciate you coming on, and you can find all of his information at li.com, which is about the easiest website we've ever given out. And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Thanks, Sean.
Thanks for having me on, Bill and Erin. It's a pleasure. Thank you.